Hey, here's something you should know. Some experts estimate that up to 77% of the population has some level of speaking anxiety. I actually thought it was higher than that. Strong communication is a critical skill for success, which is why I'd like to recommend a podcast I know you're going to love called Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by the folks at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the number one career podcast in over 95 countries, and here's why. Each week, Stanford lecturer Matt Abrahams, who, by the way, has been on this podcast a couple of times, Matt sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you improve all kinds of skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, keeping your nerves in check while speaking in front of crowds. I mean, there's a reason this show has over 42 million downloads and counting. You'll hear from people like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, speechwriter and best-selling author Daniel Pink on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness that nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. So, what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube, and you can tell them I sent you. Today on Something You Should Know, ever remember hearing that it's illegal to kill a praying mantis? I'll tell you what the law really says. Then, why do distractions suck up so much time and keep you from doing what needs to be done?
There's kind of three things that our attention gravitates to by default. The first is anything that in the moment we find pleasurable. The second is anything that in the moment we find threatening. And the third is anything that in the moment is new and novel.
Plus, why you need to put a picture of a baby in your wallet, any baby, and levity and fun in the workplace. Do they belong there?
The vast majority of people look at levity and they say, ooh, it has no place at work now. We're very serious about our mission here at Acme, Rivet, and Bolt. The fact of the matter is, most people will never suffer from having too much fun in their workplace.
All this today on Something You Should Know. Are you one of those people who just buys things with whatever credit card you grab out of your wallet? Well, that could be a costly move. NerdWallet, you've heard of NerdWallet. NerdWallet lets you compare credit cards side by side to maximize your spending. So if, for example, you like travel rewards, you can see which credit card gives you better rewards than the credit cards you've got now. Think of what you could do with better rewards. A free flight, room upgrades, who knows? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and so much more at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Credit is subject to lender approval and terms of each credit card issuer apply.
Something you should know. Fascinating intel, the world's top experts, and practical advice you can use in your life. Today, Something You Should Know with Mike Carruthers.
You know, just yesterday, I saw a praying mantis on my bathroom window. And I don't see them very often. And when I saw it, my mind immediately flashed back to when I was a kid. And I remember hearing, and I bet you have too, I remember hearing when I was a kid that killing a praying mantis was illegal, that you could go to jail or have to pay a fine. So I decided to look that up, and it turns out that it is not illegal. It's a little cruel, but it's not illegal to kill a praying mantis. The rumor's been around since the 1950s, but there are no laws on the books anywhere that say that killing a praying mantis is against the law. What is interesting, though, is some experts believe that that rumor has helped the species prosper over the years. But why would you want to kill one anyway? I mean, they're pretty cool to look at, and they devour bugs you don't really want around, like mosquitoes and moths. And what is true about the praying mantis is that after mating, the female kills and devours the male, and that is perfectly legal. And that is something you should know. I would like to believe that when you listen to this podcast, you are paying attention, that I have your undivided attention. But I'm well aware of the fact that I am competing for your attention with a lot of other distractions. For most of us, our attention is easily diverted to something else, which may be fine in some circumstances, but when you really need to stay focused on what you're doing, those distractions become a real problem. So how do you stay with the things you need to be paying attention to and keep all those other tempting distractions at bay? Well, that's what Chris Bailey is here to talk about. Chris is one of the big productivity gurus around, and he is the author of a book called Hyperfocus: How to Be More Productive in a World of Distractions. And he joins me via Skype from Canada. Hey, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
So I get the problem that you're trying to solve, but the term hyperfocus is a little intense. So why don't you explain what you mean by it?
This is a term that I use to refer to a mental state where we bring our complete deliberate attention to something. And that deliberate part, I think, is the key here, because we rarely choose when we pay attention to something. The world kind of decides for us. And so, you know, it's an intense term, hyper focus, but I think it's just basically about bringing this thoughtfulness to where we direct our attention.
Well, I think that's so true that there are so many different things you could divert your attention to. Hey, look over here at this thing. And it does seem that the more you need to be focused on something important, the more attractive those other distractions become.
Yeah. And by the way, like, I think we're hard on ourselves when we get distracted. But the one thing that I realized that kind of took a lot of weight off of my own shoulders, because, you know, this book very much came from a place of noticing that I was distracted. And so I figured, OK, if I'm such a big geek about productivity and I've been studying this stuff, maybe there's a bigger picture that I'm missing that everybody else is missing, too. And maybe this is something that other people struggle with as well. And you know, this led me to a lot of curious findings, but one was precisely that this isn't necessarily our fault. It's just simply the way our mind is wired. We're wired for distraction. And in fact, there's kind of three things that our attention gravitates to by default. The first is anything that in the moment we find pleasurable. The second is anything that in the moment we find threatening. And the third is anything that in the moment is new and novel. And so we even have a novelty bias embedded within our brain's prefrontal cortex, where it releases a hit of dopamine for every new and novel thing that we focus on. And so when you add these things together and you look at what the most pleasurable and threatening and novel things around you are, it's really not what you want to be doing. It's not the Excel budget that you're updating. It's not the big long email tome that you're responding to. It's Instagram, it's Facebook, it's Twitter, it's social media, it's the news. So, it's not really our fault, but B, you know, I think this, because of that, it is an impulse worth getting out in front of.
Well, but it may not be our fault, but we can set things up or not to be more easily. If you turn your phone off, then guess what? You can't be distracted by it.
You know, a distraction is essentially just something that in the moment is more tempting and attractive to us than what we truly ought and want to be doing. And so when we tame those things ahead of time, we give our mind no choice but to focus on what's important in front of us. So, you know, my distraction-free mode when I write, I put on noise-canceling headphones, I leave my phone in another room, I have a distraction blocking application on my computer called Freedom, where when you enable it, if you try to access social media or any sites on your list of problem websites, Reddit is one of mine. I'm a big fan of the mechanical keyboard and knitting subreddits, the two of my favorite hobbies. You know, these things will suck up a lot of time and in the moment are more attractive than the words that I want to crank out. But the idea is that by taming them ahead of time, you give yourself no choice but to focus.
But don't you ever wonder what you're missing when you turn it all off?
You do, but I think one of the things that is really helpful with that is keeping a distractions list. And so, you know, I have a sheet of paper right here that like I make a list of the things that come to mind. So if I want to check social media, I'll add that to the list of things to do when my focus timer goes off. So after the, 40, 45 minutes that I usually schedule in a writing block, I sometimes treat myself to an all-you-can-eat buffet of distraction. And this is a tactic that is actually backed up in the research where it makes us significantly less stressed when we're focusing, because we know that the distractions await us when we're done being so productive.
I like that idea, because then you have a reward for doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, like this stuff should be fun. Like that's the point of investing in your productivity. I think, this term productivity, it turns a lot of people off because it brings to mind something that feels so cold and corporate and all about this efficiency. But it's really just accomplishing what we set out to do. That's, in my opinion, a perfectly productive day. So if your intention at the start of the day is to put your feet up because you're on the beach and you're on vacation and you're sipping a Long Island iced tea and you're reading a good book, and then you accomplish all that, I would argue that you're perfectly productive. And the same is true if that intention is to have a big day at work, and that's what you want to accomplish. Ultimately, we should be kind to ourselves as we invest in our productivity. And this is kind of the ironic thing about this topic, is the idea that you want to become more productive. And, this is a topic I've been studying for a decade, so this idea comes up a lot in my own mind. It implies on some level that you're not entirely satisfied with where you're at already. And so that's kind of the art of productivity, is finding ways to be kind to yourself and reward yourself, treat yourself, make things easy on yourself, so that you can get more done without disliking your work. And so you can enjoy your work even more.
You talked about how you block out 45 minutes, and that brings up the question of, you can't go 100 miles an hour all day long. So how do we know, what does the science tell us, or what do you say about how we break up the day?
I highly recommend shrinking how long you focus for until you feel less of a resistance to doing that. And so you might ask yourself, okay, I have this report to crank out. How long do I think I could focus on just this one thing? Could I focus on the report for an hour? No, the thought of it puts me off. Okay, 45 minutes? It's a bit better, but still 30 minutes, and still 20 minutes? Yeah, I could write this report for 20 minutes. And so you get over that initial resistance. And once you go for 20 minutes, you're able to keep going, because usually the resistance we have to doing things is stacked at the beginning of a task. Our attention kind of gravitates. It flows in these 20, 25 minute blocks of time. So that's kind of a natural rhythm of our body that we can follow. But I highly recommend, notice your own energy, notice your own focus, notice your own resistance, because a big part of that is realizing how stimulated your mind is by default, because of that novelty bias where your mind releases dopamine for each new and novel thing you focus on. That's going to train you into chopping up your attention into smaller bits. One alarming study I encountered was that on average, when we're doing work in front of a computer, we focus on one thing for only 40 seconds before we switch to doing something else. And so depending on how close you are to that 40-second mark, maybe you're a bit below it, you're a bit more distracted than average, maybe you're a bit less distracted and you're able to think and focus more deeply, you'll find that the amount of time that you naturally have for something is maybe a bit shorter, maybe a bit longer. So work within that limit and, enter into your distraction-free mode during that time, but be kind to yourself at the same time and don't try to go overboard and treat yourself after, because it's, supposed to be fun.
But it is interesting that when your back's against the wall, when the deadline's approaching, somehow you can be really productive for long periods of time.
I think this is an uncomfortable truth that a lot of us need to face with our work, is sometimes the fact that we're distracted quite often is a sign that we don't have enough work to do. There's this phenomenon in productivity circles called Parkinson's Law, which states that our work tends to expand to fit how much time we have available for its completion. And so if you have, you know, 3 or 4 hours of real work to do over the course of the day, and you have an 8-hour chunk of time to do it in, you might not take on more complex projects. You might not say, okay, you know, sign me up for that event later on in the day. You might instead fill that time with email and kind of wasting time on the internet, anything that's pleasurable and threatening and novel. And so, you know, sometimes the fact that we tend to a lot of distractions is a sign that our work is expanding to fit how much time we have available for it. Because, you know, like you said, focus comes easy when we're on a deadline. You know, our work becomes more involved. It becomes more immediate. There's that feedback that we feel ourselves progressing towards that deadline. And plus, our work becomes more novel. It's more threatening because we can feel that deadline a short time away. And so I think that's something to be cognizant of, is if you find yourself falling victim to distraction a lot, maybe you have the capacity to do even more than you are already, which will make you naturally more productive.
And therein lies a problem for many people. And one of my criticisms of the whole productivity thing is, it never ends. Like, okay, so if you step up and do your work more productively, you get more work done in less time, and then you go to your boss and say, oh, my work's done. I got all this time. I've got no more work. He's just going to give you more work to do and try to get you to do it in less time. And if you're working for somebody else, there's no payoff to that. It's just more work, less time, more work, less time. To what end? What's the incentive?
I think this is how you level up in an organization, though. And maybe it's time to find a different boss if they just want you to be busy and not actually accomplish things. You know, the best bosses measure productivity not based on how busy somebody is, but how much they actually accomplish. You know, what projects they ship, which ones they lead successfully. There's a great quote where it says, "There is no love. There are only proofs of love." And I think a similar thing relates to our productivity too, where, you know, there is no productivity. There are only proofs of productivity. So, you know, kind of a big part of it is managing other people's expectations and showing them that we're hunkering down on important stuff and shipping it. But it's, that's kind of where productivity is less of a science and more of an art.
Productivity expert Chris Bailey is my guest. He's author of a book called Hyperfocus: How to Be More Productive in a World of Distraction. If you employ people, you know that finding the right person to fill a job opening can be daunting. And, you know, most people I know who run a business don't really have a proven system to do this. It can be real hit or miss, which is why if you're hiring, you need Indeed. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Indeed it's a whole hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates and find them fast. So what I love about Indeed is when you use it, you get this feeling of confidence that, yeah, this is the way to find the right people. You're not winging it or just sorting through resumes hoping to find someone. And Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from you. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. There's so many reasons to use Indeed, and there are so many reasons not to do this on your own. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/something. Just go to Indeed.com/something right now. That helps to support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/something. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So, Chris, how important is it, do you think, the way you approach and schedule your day?
I think it totally depends. Some people find that they focus best when they choose at the beginning of the day what they want to accomplish, and that's enough for them. And other people find that they focus best when they choose, you know, the main things they want to accomplish that day, but also schedule 2-3 hour blocks of time to just hunker down on those projects. And so I think depending on your need for structure, depending on your level of, you know, OCD, or, you know, how much control you like over your own life, that's something that everybody kind of needs to play around with. One fascinating study, it looked at the socioeconomic standing based on people who wake up early and people who wake up later on in the day. And the researchers found that there was zero difference in socioeconomic standing based on what time people woke up at, but rather it's how deliberately they spent their time after they woke up that made the difference in how much money they made, how successful they were, what they did for a living. And I think that's the key to productivity, is that deliberateness, that intentionality that has to precede the things that we do.
But don't you think, though, and maybe it's just me, but I suspect it's more human nature that if you write down what you're going to do today, you're much more likely to get it done than if it's some ideas floating around in your head.
One of my favorite daily rituals at the start of the day, I call it the rule of three. And it goes like this. I look at the beginning of the day and I think, if it's the end of the day, what three main things will I want to have accomplished by the time that this day is done? And it's like a simple rule. It's almost stupidly simple, but I find that three is this magical number. And it's actually, related to attention, where three or four things is the amount of things that we can keep in our working memory at one time. We used to think we could keep seven or eight, but now researchers find that it's about three or four. And you can see that the world around us is structured around this limit. You know, if you ask me, like, Chris, what's your phone number? I won't say it's, 1,613,898,000, so on and so forth. I'll say it's like 1-898 da 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 in groups of three and four. And we have sayings like, we divide events into three parts, like even a story, which is a sequence of dozens of events. We divide into the beginning, the middle, and the end. We have sayings like, good things come in threes, and celebrities die in threes, and the third time's the charm. And so it kind of fits with the way that our attention is wired, where if we define the three things that we'll want to accomplish by the day's end, we get that intentionality.
Talk about multitasking, because I think people think that they multitask and that they're good at it or not good at it, but what does the science say?
So there's this kind of unwritten rule in the productivity space that we can't multitask. But the truth is that we can multitask, but in very, very limited capacities. So I'll give you an example. Habits we can multitask with. So we can walk down the street while we chew bubble gum, while we avoid the cracks in the sidewalk, things we can do largely out of habit, while we listen to a podcast like this one. So, while a podcast kind of sops up most of our attention, the other habits we can do largely on autopilot mode. But where we run into trouble is when we try to focus on too many complex things at one time. So we can't, this is the fascinating thing about our attention, we can't actively focus on more than one thing at one time. We can't focus on having two conversations at once. We can best bounce between them. And the reason multitasking is so inefficient is really we're just switching between things rapidly on the fly. It's kind of like a movie, where a movie is, it's essentially 24 pictures a second played so fast in rapid succession that it creates the illusion of movement. That's kind of like what multitasking is we switch between things so often that we feel like we're doing them at the same time, but really we're just rapidly switching between them. And the reason that multitasking doesn't work is because of a phenomenon called attention residue, where it's actually impossible to cleanly switch from doing one thing to doing another thing. And so we're having this conversation right now. If right after we check our email, we can't completely focus on checking our email because a part of us will be remembering this conversation. But this happens for things that we say switch between every 40 seconds or so, where we're always remembering and a part of our attention is always devoted to what we were just focusing on, which prevents us from getting immersed in whatever's in front of us. And in research, like if we could focus from one thing to the next seamlessly and cleanly, this wouldn't be a problem. You know, we could easily, multitask, but our work has been shown because of this attention residue to take about 50% longer as opposed to when we just hunker down on one thing, when we get into that distraction-free mode, when we tame distractions like our smartphone ahead of time, when we leave it in another room when we're writing or working or in a meeting. You know, these are all things that we can do. And so the longer we can focus on one thing for, I think this is one of the best measures of the quality of our attention because that's everything. You know, that dictates how stimulated our mind is by default. That dictates how meaningful our experiences are because we're able to process them in the first place. And, you know, productivity is kind of a side effect of doing all that well.
When I think about productivity, I think about that term. I think, you know, that's all about getting more things done in less time. But equally as important is to get things done better, the quality of the work. And I wonder what in the productivity world does the research say about getting away from work, sleeping on it, distracting yourself to get good ideas? Is all of that just anecdotal or is there real science there?
There's science there, and actually fascinating science. In fact, deliberately letting our mind wander is one of the best things that we can do for our creativity. And, you know, frankly, most of us have enough data at our disposal. If you think back to when your last most brilliant light bulb insight struck you, you probably weren't focused on anything. You were probably, you know, maybe you were taking a shower. Maybe you were swimming laps at the pool. Maybe you were having your morning coffee with just a notepad, or, you know, chances are you were doing two things. You were doing something that was relatively habitual that didn't consume your full attentions. And so because of that, second of all, your mind had the chance to wander. And the reason this mode is so productive is our mind wanders to some fascinating places. In research, it's called our mind's prospective bias. We think about our goals 14 times as often when our mind is wandering versus when we're focused. And so it's when we're focused that we move our work forward, but it's when our mind is wandering, especially when we're doing something simple and habitual at the same time, that we think about the future, that we set intentions. You know, it's in the walk down the hallway when we're on our way to a meeting that we think about what we want to get accomplished in that meeting if we're not looking down at our phone. So, you know, in addition to wandering to the future, we also wander to think about the present a little bit as well. We think about the present about 28% of the time. So this is when we're thinking more strategically, when our mind is wandering.
Well, great. You've given us some terrific information about how focus really does work inside the brain and how to use it to your advantage. Chris Bailey has been my guest. He is a productivity expert and he's author of the book, Hyperfocus: How to Be More Productive in a World of Distraction. There's a link to his book in the show notes. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Kinda by definition, workplaces tend to be pretty serious. After all, it's work, and we're trying to get things done, and there isn't a lot of time for joking around. Well, maybe there should be some time for joking around, because there are some big benefits to a little humor. That's the message from Scott Christopher. He is the co-author of the book, The Levity Effect, Why It Pays to Lighten Up. And he's looked into the research regarding humor and work. Hey, Scott, so what do we know? What are the benefits right off the bat here? What are the benefits of humor in the workplace? What do we know?
We've found that those who possess a sense of humor, or at least an ability to appreciate humor, tend to climb the corporate ladder quicker. They actually end up making a little more money. They're perceived by their peers as being able to climb that ladder faster as well. And plus, just the sense that, you know, you laugh a lot, you enjoy life, it's great for the brain. You know, your body's more oxygenated, the vasodilatation of the arteries and blood vessels carries more oxygen. When people are lightened up, when they're relaxed, they tend to do better work.
And yet, I think the attitude in so many workplaces is that we need to nose to the grindstone, let's get business done. We don't have time for that.
Yeah, there is kind of that stigma that, hey, you know, if you're the joker, you're probably lazy. Or if you're a goofball, you possess zero credibility. And that's, you know, that's the mountain we climb when we went out to do this research. For many people, they'll say, this is just a big fat duh. Like, we knew this all along, that there are people that have a great sense of humor and a kind of a lightness of being, and naturally people are more drawn to them. But like you're saying, you know, really the vast majority of people look at levity and they say, ooh, it has no place at work now. We're very serious about our mission here at Acme, Rivet, and Bolt, you know, where our aim is to save the world. The fact of the matter is that most people will never suffer from having too much fun in their workplace.
Well, it all sounds good, and I think we'd all like to think that a fun place to work would be a good place to work and be a productive place to work, and that's what you're saying, but how do you know that? Where's the proof of this?
You know, a lot of people are familiar with the best places to work in America list. Fortune magazine puts it out every year, and it's the top 100 places to work based on things like camaraderie, trust, fun at work, friends. I mean, there's different factors that go into being part of this best places to work in America. And we were able to have access to a lot of the research that goes into coming up with this list. And interestingly enough, we found a connection between the companies where employees say, this is definitely a fun place to work, where there is humor and lightness. We found the connection that the majority of those that are on that top 100 list outscored the other companies that just made the good list by, in some cases, 20 to 25 percentage points. And when the statisticians went back in, they said, you know, this is a fairly significant finding. This has even made us kind of raise our eyebrows. This is what they're telling us is, wow, there's a correlation between having fun at work and having a stronger work environment. For many people, that won't be a surprise. But what's interesting is those companies that are on that Best Place to Work Institute aren't necessarily in the poorhouse. In fact, they did a little bit of research, and they said if you were to take your, you know, your retirement funds, your investment, and put it into the best places to work companies, over a five-year period, you actually get a five times greater return than if you just left it in the S&P 500, for example. So these companies that are considered great places to work actually outperform other companies, and a big factor to that is this sense of levity within the actual workplace.
So what does that look like? How is it different to go to work in one of these fun places compared to a more conventional workplace?
Well, you know what? You're equally as excited to get to work as you are to turn around and leave work. You know, you feel like you have friends there. You know, most of us, our dream job is to just enjoy what we do. You ask somebody, what is it that you'd love to do? I just want to find something that I'm good at and that I really enjoy. And that, would, for me, would be the ideal job. And part of enjoying what you do is enjoying the people that are around you. And a lot of that starts with, in most cases, management. You know, if they can learn to lighten up a little bit and allow levity to happen, it doesn't mean that they have to be stand-up comics. But if there is a stand-up comic, allow this person to bring that a little bit. Obviously, there's time and place, rules, there's appropriateness, things like that, but generally speaking, it feels great. I work in an environment myself where we have a lot of fun. We just got done playing foosball upstairs after our lunch break. And I come back to my desk and I feel reinvigorated. I'm a little more excited to go after my work. And ideas tend to flow a little more smoothly.
But if you work in a workplace that is more conventional, there isn't a lot of joking around. How in the world are you going to go in tomorrow and say, hey, guys, we're going to yuck it up today? I mean, how do you introduce this if it's never been there?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there's a few things you can do to kind of just work your way into it. One thing that we suggest is when you, maybe on that first morning you come to work, maybe stop off and grab some donuts and coffee or whatever for people, just as a gesture of goodwill, and that, you know, bringing in snacks and treats isn't anything new, but it is an indication that you're willing to kind of make things a little lighter. Another thing, you know, is that, you know, change up your voicemail greeting. A lot of us have kind of these robotic, very staid, basic greetings that we have on there. And I think there's a way, without turning it into shtick, you know, there's a way to just be a normal person. In fact, there's a way to put a phone greeting on that sounds like you talking to someone face-to-face rather than just into a machine. Some companies will put together a fun bunch, if you call them whatever you will, but maybe a rotating committee of people that whose task is to come up with some ways that we can have fun within our work group, things that people agree on, stuff that we can do together. Maybe we go bowling once a month during lunch, or, you know, we blast music really loud at 3 o'clock, and on Thursday, that's your day, so you get to choose from your iTunes. It's something, you know, that ties back to who these people are in terms of their relationship as workmates. It's not necessarily programmed and forced upon them. It's more organic. It's born of who they are at work.
Well, what about the actual work itself? I mean, it sounds, if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like, you know, you're stopping work to go play foosball, that you're not injecting humor into doing the work. You're stopping work to have fun. The two are oil and water and they don't mix. Or do they?
Yeah. Again, it kind of depends on each organization. You know, where you're stopping down, many organizations allow, obviously, for breaks anyway. It's not something that we'd suggest you do every single break or every single day, for that matter. And one thing that we do think is critical, as you mentioned, Mike, is to link the humor, link the levity to work, if at all possible. One way to do that is to allow levity to happen in meetings, in brainstorm sessions. You know, start things off with pizza and pop or whatever, and let people just kind of catch up on what's going on. Kind of get things loosened up. And in fact, more creative ideas can come from that. You know, occasionally people might get outside on a nice spring warm day and throw a Frisbee around. Now, will they do that as recess every day? Probably not. But occasionally, if your people come to you and they have suggestions for ways that they just need to lighten up and loosen up, allow those things to happen. Because chances are they won't overstep those boundaries. They respect the fact and appreciate the fact that you're allowing them a little rope, and they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them. You know, they won't overdo it. And yet it's that, just that little gesture that I think helps build a great leader in terms of levity.
Do you ever find, though, that when you allow levity between people in an organization, when you lighten things up, that then there's a tendency to want to take that levity and lightness in interactions with people in other organizations where maybe this isn't so appropriate and that could cause trouble?
Well, I'm sure that's possible, yes. The idea here is to allow people to have levity within their comfort zone. You're certainly going to have people, regardless of how much you try to do, that simply aren't comfortable with having fun at work, or that, you know, maybe step aside. And to that we say, let them be. As in all things, it's lightening up. So lighten up with those who don't want to lighten up. If they don't want to, that's the beauty of it. And so obviously, where we're trying to keep things appropriate, where we understand that there's a time and place rule involved, it does require that you've hired people with a sense of judgment as well as a sense of humor. And so hopefully they understand, you know, who they are, how they represent the organization, so when they're dealing with outside clients.
Anybody who's worked in a place that allows this, and I know I have, I can recall early in my career working in places where, you know, Friday afternoons, things were a little looser and we used to have fun and do things. People remember that. People remember that fondly. And I think they would say that, yeah, there was a real payoff to that.
I think so. You said it. Who was your? Let me ask you this: who was your favorite boss ever? You know, think about the one person you reported to that was just went down in history as your most favorite ever. Chances are, they probably led with a degree of levity. Typically, those were your favorite bosses.
Yeah. The informality of it made everybody seem a little more real, a little more human, and it made things less stressful.
Right. You're not stressed out. You don't feel as much pressure. You don't have that gnawing in your gut like, oh, honey, I'll see you later. I've got to go to work, and I got to face the boss. When there's levity, when there's that sense that everything's okay, you know, the world's not going to end, it makes it that much easier, in fact, that much more fun to want to get to work. You don't want to miss out on what people say today or what little viral email might go around. That's appropriately funny. You want to be there for that.
So if you want to institute this culture of levity into a workplace, it would seem to me that that would have to come from the top down, that, you know, average Joe grunt worker guy, who's probably the funniest guy at the company, can't just walk in tomorrow and start, you know, yucking it up and telling jokes. Isn't it more of a cultural thing?
Well, you'd be surprised. You can. I think a lot of grunt workers, so to speak, probably possess latent, you know, howling, side-splitting senses of humor, and they're afraid to unleash them for fear of a lack of credibility. By the same token, leaders face that same dilemma. You're right, though, that it has to be, at some point, this kind of trickle-down effect. And so when we write and we speak to companies, we always try to include those senior-level bosses, the CEO, et cetera. In fact, a lot of the research that's been done, some of it at least, talks about, you know, a CEO's desire to hire people with a sense of humor. In fact, one study found that 98% of North American CEOs would prefer to hire someone who has a very apparent sense of humor over someone who is a little more dour, who takes things a little more gravely. They want that within their organization. So we're hoping that they also possess that same quality. By the same token, 84% of coworkers believe that their coworkers that have humor actually do better. They might not necessarily be sneaking in and looking at their paycheck and payroll and seeing how much money they're making, but they tend to believe this guy's going places. He probably makes more than I do. He'll be promoted faster. And so, yeah, as a regular day-to-day worker, you know, bring some of that. You don't have to force it on an unsuspecting audience, but just bring the general demeanor.
Well, it's a good message, and it's one I think people like hearing because it validates what I think a lot of us like to believe, that fun has a place in the workplace, and it does have benefits that really do pay off. Scott Christopher has been my guest. The name of his book is The Levity Effect, Why It Pays to Lighten Up. And there's a link to his book in the show notes. Probably one of the worst feelings there is that feeling when you realize you've lost your wallet. You've looked everywhere, and it finally dawns on you, it's gone. You've left it somewhere, you dropped it somewhere, and now whether or not you get it back is entirely up to the kindness of strangers. Well, one thing you might want to do is put a picture of a baby inside your wallet. A group of researchers scattered phony lost wallets around to see which ones were most likely to be returned. And get this, 88% of all the wallets returned were the ones that had pictures of smiling babies in them. Dr. Richard Wiseman, author of the study, says he chalks this up to an evolutionary quirk. Human beings naturally feel more responsible towards babies, even when the baby isn't their own. Here's how the other wallets came back. Those with a picture of a puppy, 53% of those wallets came back. And a picture of a happy family, just 48% of those wallets came back. And that is something you should know. Questions, comments, or just want to say hi, you can always get me at my email address, which is mike@somethingyoushouldknow.net. I'm Mike Carruthers. Thanks for listening today to Something You Should Know. No matter what moves you made last year, TurboTax experts make them count. Did you maybe buy a second property to rent out? That's a move. Did you go back to school to get your degree? That too is a move, a smart move. Did you commute to work across state lines? You see, that's a move. Did you relocate for a fresh start? Well, that's the definition of a move. Maybe you moved into a houseboat instead of a house. Or perhaps you crushed it in the stock market in 2023. TurboTax experts make all your moves count, getting you every credit and deduction you deserve, filing with 100% accuracy, and getting your max refund guaranteed. Switch to TurboTax, make your moves, and they will make them count. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees. Experts only available with TurboTax Live. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.